You really want to be better with your finances. You try to put money away in savings. You look for deals. You wrote out a budget once a long time ago. Yet you still overdraft from time to time and you still have debt. The truth is, managing money is not easy, but Rocket Money can help. Rocket Money shows you exactly what you're spending every month. From there, the app helps you make a budget that meets your financial goals. The app even gives you real-time alerts when you're about to go over your budget so you don't spend too much. With Rocket Money, you can also see all of your subscriptions at a glance and cancel the ones you don't want right from the app. Rocket Money can even try to get you a refund for some of the money you wasted. Plus, you can use the smart savings feature to start putting more money away. Rocket Money analyzes your accounts to determine the optimal time to stow away cash without going over your budget. Our members report that the Rocket Money app saved them more than $700 a year. Getting better with money doesn't have to be a pipe dream. Rocket Money can make it a reality. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple app or Google Play stores.
Marriott Bonvoy is the official hotel partner of US soccer. Join Marriott Bonvoy today to get closer to the game with exclusive perks, unforgettable experiences, and benefits that go beyond the pitch. Spring Hill Suites, part of Marriott Bonvoy, offers complimentary hot breakfast and spacious all-suite accommodations, perfect for the whole team, with room for up to 6 guests. Make your next getaway a win. Learn more at springhillsuites.marriott.com.
Battles of conscience, British pacifists, and the Second World War. We know a lot about conscientious objectors in the First World War, but a groundbreaking new study brings us a very different picture of the Second World War, asking fundamental questions about ethical commitments. It's a new book by Tobias Kelly. Delighted to be joining me live on the line from Scotland, Tobias himself. Tobias, good morning to you.
Morning. Thank you very much for having me.
Pleasure is all mine. We know all about the First World War and conscientious objectors and the fact that, you know, we have come to understand their reasons. The Second World War seems to be a different situation as we maybe think of it in black and white terms between good and evil. Why do we have this misconception of conscientious objectors, do you think, in the Second World War? And why were people deciding not to fight against the rise of the Nazis?
It's a very good question. It's a popular memory of the First World War largely sees it as a waste, as, you know, a terrible tragedy. So therefore, the people who refuse to fight are giving a kind of grudging respect, whereas we find it much more difficult to place the conscientious objectors of the Second World War. Partly because the Second World War was the good war. It was the war against fascism. So refusing to fight fascism is much more ambiguous in many people's eyes, speaking from the 21st century. But if we go back to 1939, what they were worried about, what many of the pacifists and others who refused to fight, was they were seeing this war through the lens of the First World War, and they didn't want that to be repeated. So it was the First World War and the images of the trenches that were dominating their thoughts.
Because I suppose, I mean, we look back from a 21st century perspective, we know what happens. We have the benefit of hindsight. But if you're there in real time, if you will, you've seen the rise of Nazism, you've seen the rise of communism, of course, over in the Soviet Union, and the horrors and the damaged people that came back from the Western Front are still, they're not only live in the memory, but, you know, you walk out onto a high street in 1938, 1939, and you see them.
Very much so. And it's important to remember that in the early 1930s to the mid-1930s, kind of anti-war attitudes were very much of what other historians have called middle opinion. They were a respectable part of public and political and social life across the political spectrum. So people were deeply worried that if a new war came, it would be similar to the First World War, and it would be even worse in its destruction because of advances in technology and aircraft, in gas. And fascism, they wanted to fight fascism, but it's also important to remember that when they did go to war in 1939, the Holocaust and the genocide were not the top of people's minds. They weren't significant war aims on the British side. And we see that very much from the 21st century. So we shouldn't forget that they weren't refusing to save or prevent a genocide. They were refusing to fight a war that they thought was going to be similar to the First World War.
And of course, there had been a large movement of appeasement. I mean, we now look back and think, oh, Britain stood alone. But you think of Lord Halifax and the months leading up, and Germany was seen up until the very last months before the conflict started as they're fellow Europeans. Our royals were Saxe-Coburgs, for goodness sake. So therefore, these were fellow Europeans, and we were, if you like, more closely related by blood ties, especially from the upper classes, than we were to say the French or the Italians.
But also culturally as well, if you read through the memoirs and diaries of young people in the 1930s, they looked to Germany for their cultural references. They often went on holiday, on walking tours. They went to Berlin to see music and plays. So Germany was seen as being slightly decaying and eroded, but definitely kind of where civilization took place.
Looking at the people then, I mean, war breaks out and there is this, are we right in thinking there's a huge support for getting involved in this war once Poland is invading? And what happens to the conscientious objectors? What happens to the people who have said, presumably before, I'm not going to get involved with this war?
It's an interesting question, and there's kind of debates over the kind of the motivations and enthusiasm with which people went to war. The overwhelming sense is that most soldiers were what the historian Alan Allport has called browned off. They were reluctant, a bit annoyed, but they were still going to fight because they thought they essentially had no choice and it was the best thing to do. So there wasn't this kind of overwhelming sense of enthusiasm volunteering as you got in 1914 in the First World War, partly because of the memories of what had happened to the volunteers. So what happened to the conscientious objectors? There was, again, an interesting contrast with the First World War, where they were stigmatized and pilloried and given white feathers and so on. They could have a very difficult time, sometimes at a personal level. And my book is full of examples of arguments with mothers and boyfriends and employers and people in the pub and so on. But there was on the whole, what you might call a kind of a grudging respect, a grudging tolerance towards them. And even people like the Archbishop of Canterbury would say things like, or Winston Churchill on occasion, that conscientious objection was one of the key freedoms for which the war was being fought.
Yes, it's an interesting one, isn't it? Because, you think that Churchill's going to say, well, throw them all in internment camps. But if you're fighting, if the lights are going out, quote-unquote, all over Europe, as he famously said, then you have to respect, you may not agree with the fact that these people do not want to fight, but if you are fighting for liberty, then that liberty demands that you give these people the right to object.
That's very much as it was rhetorically seen, and there's a very real truth to that. In practice, what happened, though, was that the freedom was respected within a very particular terrain. So not all conscientious objectors were necessarily treated equally, and it wasn't always easy for a conscientious objector to persuade the tribunal, and their cases were decided by a tribunal made up of a judge and a local worthies. It wasn't always so easy for people to persuade those tribunals that they were genuine and sincere. So if you were a Protestant, and a Quaker in particular, you had it relatively easy. But if you were a Catholic, for all sorts of interesting reasons, it could be very difficult to persuade a tribunal you were sincere in your objection. If you were a socialist or an anarchist or a Scottish nationalist, it was almost impossible.
What exactly were the tribunals then? For those listening who don't know what the tribunals were you just described.
So they were a panel of three people, almost always men, at a local level. And you would have to write a short form, a very, very short form, half a page long, where you would say, I object to armed service on the grounds of my conscientious objection because of X, Y, and Z, because I'm a socialist, or because I'm a believer in Jesus Christ and I follow a particular church, and so on. And then they would have to go to the tribunal and put their conscience on the line to kind of persuade someone else that actually they weren't hiding or they weren't dissimulating. They had to put this most private and intimate thing, their conscience, out there in public for other people to judge.
It's an interesting one, isn't it? Because if you think about the way that, you know, young men rushed to join, to sign up during the First World War, and the period, say, between the wars then marks this individual liberty thing. We have the Spanish Civil War, for example, where you have the International Brigades. I'm sitting in a studio in Spain, and we remember this well. And it was that defense of liberty, but that defense of the individual, where you can conscientiously object and you go in front of a tribunal, which, you know, marks the, you know, if you like, it's the end of that empire, that Victorian to serve one's country no matter what approach.
It's interesting because one of the things that conscientious objectors often didn't say was they didn't talk about freedom. They didn't see conscience as about a fundamental individual freedom. Some of them did, of course. On the whole, they saw it as an obligation. They had a duty to follow their conscience, and they had a duty not to take up arms. But they were also, and this is one of the interesting things about them, they were also, on the whole, very keen to stress their patriotism. They were very keen to say how much they loved Britain and how refusing to fight or following their conscience was part of what it meant to them to be British.
The book looks at five individual cases from all strata of the social classes, if you like. And one that catches my eye is Stella St. John, who ends up in jail. Tell me a little bit about, you know, that particular case.
Stella's a kind of wonderful, wonderful example. Very interesting woman. She came from a kind of a slightly aristocratic family, but fell out with her parents. She wanted to be a doctor, and they wouldn't let her. So she went to work in a market garden. And when they died, she inherited a small amount of money and trained to be a vet. And then lived in a commune in North London, and when war started, she started volunteering for a shelter under Hungerford Bridge, where all the down and outs who had been thrown out of the tubes because people thought they were too infested with louse and diseases and so on, would find shelter, and she would serve them tea and food and look after them and help clean them up and so on. But on top of that, she also drove an ambulance around Marrowbone, so taking people who'd been injured by the Blitz, and her accounts at the time are full of horrific sights, and worked as a vet. But interestingly, when a form of conscription was introduced for women later on in the war, where they could be directed to particular types of service, and she was directed to a tabulating company. So she was doing all this work. She was driving an ambulance. She was looking after the homeless. She was working as a vet. But she refused to be directed to a tabulating company to be directed. She said, I must follow my conscience. I can be of much more use doing all this other stuff. Therefore, I'm going to refuse to be directed in this way. And she ended up in jail, spending time in Holloway Prison. But she saw that time in jail as a kind of a test of her convictions, as a test, as a way of proving to herself that she was sincere in her conscience.
And also, is it Fred Urquhart, you know, working class Scottish socialist and writer? I like Fred already. Tell me a little bit about his journey, as the saying goes.
Well, Fred, another very interesting man. He actually grew up 200 metres away from where I'm sitting, down by the Firth of Forth in Edinburgh. 1930s, he was a kind of left school at 16, worked in a bookshop stuffing envelopes, but kind of had ambitions to be a writer. And he, more than anyone, was kind of haunted by images of the First World War. You know, he read books, he went to see films, and his diaries are full of kind of images and dreams of what would happen if he went to war. First time around, he was rejected because he saw himself as a socialist, and the tribunals tended to not like socialists going before the tribunals. He was lucky that second time around, on his appeal, he was represented by a man called Gordon Stott, who would later on become one of the most senior lawyers in Scotland. And he was advised, quite rightly, in practical terms, to downplay his socialism and foregrounded his humanitarian sentiments. And he spent the rest of the war on a potato farm out near Aberdeen, literally picking potatoes as part of his war service.
How do you find these cases? Because I'm an armchair historian, one of the worst sorts. But how did you find these? Because we don't know that much about conscientious objectors in the Second World War. So how did you come across them?
It's interesting because they are actually everywhere. There were 60,000 of them, and many of them went on to lead leading roles in public life. Benjamin Britten and Michael Tippett, the composers, Harold Pinter after the war, David Hockney after the war, was conscientious objectors. So they're threaded through history, but you often see in a footnote, oh, and by the way, during the Second World War, they served as a conscientious objector. They were a conscientious objector. So they're often hiding in plain sight. And then you can find them in all sorts of places. The five people I follow, partly they were serendipity. So Fred Urquhart was born just near where I live. I follow a very interesting man called Tom Burns, who worked as an ambulance driver and was actually working as an ambulance driver on the front in Finland as a conscientious objector, whilst the British Army was largely still back in base in Britain. Later on in the war, he was working as an ambulance driver in Greece and was captured by the Germans and spent 2 years in a prisoner of war camp alongside other British soldiers. And Tom Burns, this happens to be the father of my old next door neighbour. I was telling her I was writing this book, and she said, oh, my father was a conscientious objector. I've got all his letters from when he was a prisoner of war. Would you like to see them? And they're the most amazing resource.
I'm just thinking of the reaction he must have got from serving soldiers if he was in a camp, and you've got, you know, Tommy there who's you know, fought his way through whatever, being captured, and then he's sitting next to a guy, okay, you've been an ambulance driver, brave enough, but suddenly he's found himself with a bunch of squaddies who perhaps didn't exactly take on the ideological behaviours and ideas that he had.
It's a really interesting question, because not just in Tom Burns' case, but with all the others, as long as the conscientious objectors were doing something, ambulance work, working in a hospital, working on a farm, going down a mine, the overwhelming sense is of mutual respect between soldiers and conscientious objectors. They were almost more similar than those who weren't fighting, who weren't signed up. So Tom Burns' diaries and his letters are full of examples of how well he got on with the other soldiers, the friendships he made, and the ways in which they respected him for his position. Partly because he was so willing to go out, get his hands dirty, go to the front line, even if he wasn't willing to carry a weapon.
The book is called Battles of Conscience, British Pacifists in the Second World War. It's by Tobias Kelly, who we've been speaking to today. Tobias, if people want to find out more information about you or the book, where can they find you, or where can they find the publisher?
It's published by Penguin, so the easiest way is to Google Penguin and Battles of Conscience, and you can find your way to the book, to the ebook, and also the audiobook.
The book is called Battles of Conscience. It's by Tobias Kelly, who's been speaking to you today. Tobias, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much for having me.
Marriott Bonvoy is the official hotel partner of US Soccer. Join Marriott Bonvoy today to get closer to the game with exclusive perks, unforgettable experiences, and benefits that go beyond the pitch. Spring Hill Suites, part of Marriott Bonvoy, offers complimentary hot breakfast and spacious all-suite accommodations, perfect for the whole team, with room for up to 6 guests. Make your next getaway a win. Learn more at springhillsuites.marriott.com.